Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up...
ARs are what's used in video games, they're what's used in movies, they're what's used in actual conflicts. It's kind of like America's rifle.
The AR-15. It's the civilian version of the military's M-16.
Those design features in a civilian market have horrific consequences. It has the capability that the military wanted for warfare.
We'll look at the history of a controversial firearm. Also today, Seth Mnookin is a recovering heroin addict. He'd been sober for years, but then he had to undergo a painful hospital procedure and was prescribed opioid painkillers.
You know, one false step, and it's not as if then I start the path to addiction again. It's as if those 18 years never happened.
All that and sports with Bill Littlefield next on Radio Boston. First, the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and we're going to start today with the latest in the national debate on gun control. Right now, on the Senate floor, Democrats are filibustering in an attempt to call for congressional action on proposed gun legislations. Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy launched the surprise filibuster at 11:21 this morning.
I'm at my wit's end. I've had enough of the ongoing slaughter of innocents, and I've had enough of inaction in this body.
Murphy says he won't end the filibuster until he receives assurance that the Senate will take action on legislation on universal background checks and preventing people on the FBI's terrorism watch list from buying firearms. Murphy is, however, yielding briefly to other Democratic senators for questions. Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey spoke a little while ago.
The National Rifle Association does not want potential terrorists to be denied purchasing guns in the United States. Now, what kind of crazy position is that for the NRA to take? That potential terrorists should be allowed to buy guns in the United States.
So the filibuster in the Senate continues. On the House side, things are no less contentious. Yesterday, Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton tweeted a picture of himself in fatigues and holding a military rifle. He's a Marine veteran who served 4 tours of duty in Iraq. And along with that picture, he tweeted the words, "I know assault rifles. I carried one in Iraq. They have no place on America's streets." Congressman Moulton joins us now. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Great to be back.
So, Congressman, tell us a little bit more. Do you have a specific proposal in mind when you say that that the type of rifle you know has no place on America's streets?
Absolutely. We should reinstate the assault weapons ban. It's a law that we passed about a decade ago. It was in place for a couple decades ago. It was in place for a decade. And it would have prevented Omar Mateen from buying the gun that he used to slaughter 49 innocent people in Orlando.
Well, I mean, let's be honest, though. What chance is there any chance of that happening? Is there any chance of there even being debate on the assault weapons ban in the House?
Look, it's incredibly frustrating. I mean, there's been more debate on my social media pages than there has been about gun control in the Houses of Congress. But that's got to change. And I'm confident it will change someday. I just don't know how many more innocent Americans have to die before the Republicans wake up to having this debate and doing our job.
Now, Congressman Moulton, there has been a lot of attention in the wake of what happened in Orlando on these particular types of weapons once again in the United States. But on the other hand, as you know, many experts say that the assault weapons ban had a lot of loopholes in it when it was enacted in those 10 years between 1994 and 2004, and that it was pretty ineffective in curbing overall gun violence, even if it may have reduced the incidence temporarily of mass shootings. So why would the Omar Mateen example, which is an important one, but that example aside, why do you think reinstating the ban would be effective when we talk about gun violence overall?
Well, it's a common sense step in the right direction. And certainly the scourge of mass shootings that we see in America today wasn't so bad back when the assault weapons ban was in place, because people didn't have access to these weapons of mass murder. There are a lot of things that we need to do to curb this violence. And frankly, we should be willing to have a good, honest debate about exactly what type of assault weapons ban we pass to make sure that there aren't the loopholes in the new law that there were in the previous one. But we've got to take these common sense steps that so many Americans, Republicans and Democrats alike, demand. And yet today in Washington, the Speaker of the House won't even let us have a debate or a vote on the issue.
Now, Congressman Moulton, I'm thinking about that picture that you tweeted yesterday, and I'm wondering, I mean, you have used a military-style assault weapon, a fully automatic one, in the theater of war. Can you tell us what it was like to use that weapon and what made it good for you as a Marine in Iraq that you think doesn't make it good for civilian use?
I mean, look, these weapons are designed to kill people, and, you know, sadly, that's the job of our armed services, and that's why they're important to have overseas. But they have no place here at home. You know, no hunter needs an AR-15 to hunt, unless he has no idea how to hunt, I guess. These are weapons of war. And in the same way that we outlaw other weapons of war, like landmines or anti-tank rockets, because we deem them too unsafe to have here at home, we should outlaw assault rifles as well.
Now, just to be clear, of course, you were using in the military, you were using a fully automatic one, whereas the military style weapons for civilian use are semi-automatic. Is that a meaningful enough difference for you?
No, absolutely not. In fact, you know, the training in the Marines is that you always shoot on semi-automatic. That's the most effective way to use the weapon and not overuse your ammunition. It's really a silly distinction, and if you really want to get technical about it, I think that arms manufacturers would say that automatic really refers to the type of cycling where you don't have to reload a round into the chamber manually. And so whether it's a semi-automatic or a fully automatic weapon, it's still an automatic weapon. And they have no place on our streets.
Now, finally, Congressman Moulton, if I can just shift gears a tiny bit with you, away from the assault weapons ban question. You also have been critical of the Obama administration's strategy in combating ISIS in the past. You and I have talked about this before, and you've said that the Obama administration doesn't have a long-term strategy, and that made me wonder. I wonder what you made of what the president said yesterday when he gave that quite impassioned speech after speaking with members of his national security advisors, because he said that he's added more U.S. personnel in Syria and Iraq, that the military has launched 13,000 airstrikes and taken out 120 top ISIS leaders, and that ISIS has lost nearly half of the populated territory it once controlled, Iraq. And the president also said the group is losing ground in Syria. And I was wondering if you two thought that was progress or not enough.
No, it's absolutely progress, and I think it's important to be clear about my criticism here. The Obama administration has done a fantastic job of ensuring a military defeat of ISIS. The president is absolutely right. They haven't gained any territory since sometime over a year ago. We are going to defeat them. I've been to the front lines. I was there just a couple months ago as a member of the House Armed Services Committee to see how the troops are doing. We will defeat ISIS on the ground. But what I want to make sure is that after we do defeat ISIS, we don't have a lack of a political solution that would just allow another group like ISIS to come in its place, the same way that ISIS came into Iraq after we defeated Al-Qaeda in Iraq during the surge. So what I'm talking about is the importance of a long-term political solution so that we don't have to keep sending our troops back to the Middle East to clean up the mess. Mm-hmm. But in terms of cleaning up this mess that ISIS has created, our military strategy is actually going quite well.
That's Congressman Seth Moulton. He represents Massachusetts' 6th District. Always good to talk with you, Congressman Moulton. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
while Congressman Moulton mentioned a particular style of weapon available for sale legally in the United States. It's the AR-15. It's a military-style semi-automatic rifle that's made by more than 30 manufacturers and represents 60% of all civilian rifle sales. And that's according to the National Shooting Sports Foundation, an industry trade group. Approximately 8 million of these rifles have been sold in the United States, and the vast majority of them are used by law-abiding gun owners. However, as Congressman Moulton pointed out, a few have been used in some of America's deadliest mass shootings, including Aurora, Colorado, San Bernardino, California, and Newtown, Connecticut. Several media outlets are reporting that the Orlando shooter used a handgun and a Sig Sauer MCX semi-automatic rifle. That's a cousin to the AR-15. So these firearms are now under renewed scrutiny by gun control advocates, and they're also receiving vigorous defense from gun rights groups. But we want to take a step back here for a moment and walk through the story of how a weapon designed for the military became one of the country's most popular civilian firearms. Or, as the NRA calls it, America's rifle. For that, we're joined by Jay Wachtel. He was a special agent and supervisor with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms for 23 years. He's now a lecturer at Cal State Fullerton, and he joins us from NPR West in California. Jay Wachtel, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
Well, it's great to have you on the show and to help us walk through this history. I mean, start us off. When and where did the AR-15 style of rifle first make its appearance in the United States?
That was in the early 60s when it was adopted by the American military. The original design was from a company known as Armalite, and the design was sold to Colt. And by the early 60s, it was in wide use in the military. When I enlisted in the Army, that was in the mid-60s, the Army was then transitioning from the M14 rifle to the AR-15.
Interesting. So I'm seeing here that the first AR-15s were designed, as you said, in the 1950s by Eugene Stoner, who was a former Marine, and he developed it for military standards and for military service. And the military version was the M16. So you used this weapon, the M16, in Vietnam?
That's correct.
And what is it like to fire? How does it handle as a firearm?
Compared to the M14 rifles that we had before, it's a totally different weapon. The M14s kick like a mule. Every time you discharged the round, it was like it was going to take your shoulder off. But the design of the AR-15 is just simply amazing. There's virtually no recoil, so you can repeatedly, with great accuracy, put rounds on target. In a way that you could never try to do with the M14.
Huh. So no recoil. It's also pretty light. And we've been seeing all day long from people who own these weapons that its customizability is something that people really appreciate.
It is. It's a very compact weapon. It's, as you said, it's very light. It's a completely different animal. We had to... When I arrived in Vietnam, they actually had to retrain us, get us to forget about the M14 because the AR-15 or the M16 was a much, much different weapon. And because of that, far more lethal as well.
And I understand that some of the things that made it revolutionary at the time that it was first developed and then used by the developed and then later used by the military in Vietnam, as you're saying, is that it fires a relatively small caliber bullet, the 223, right? And it's a high-velocity bullet as well. So what does that mean for the kind of damage that it does to, you know, the person or object that it's being fired at?
The 223 round is a devastating projectile. Its muzzle velocity is so great that when it enters the body, it creates what's called a temporary wound cavity that's many times the diameter of the projectile. So the damage it does, it doesn't have to strike a direct hit. It can pulverize your organs even with a poorly placed shot.
Hmm. So the military, in terms of the purposes that the United States military would want such a weapon, they got exactly what they wanted. I mean, I understand that you, I mean, members of the military are trained to use these weapons, but you don't have to have the best aim in order to use it to inflict the kind of damage you were talking about.
That's exactly the point. And during our training, I remember that being said, that you don't have to be the best shooter in the world to bring someone down and make sure that they stay down.
Huh. So how is it and when did the AR-15 style of rifle go from being primarily manufactured for the military to being manufactured for civilians, or for civilian use and sales?
Virtually instantly. Colt realized that they had a very marketable weapon on hand, were firearms enthusiasts, and partly because of our involvement, you know, in Vietnam and the popularity of the rifle, you know, would be more than happy to, you know, purchase the weapons. So it was in the early 60s when Colt started selling them for civilian use. Now, they were, as you said before, they were the semi-automatic version, but they fired the same cartridge, and their accuracy at range, their cyclic rate, the ability to put rounds on target, and the devastating effect of their projectile was the same.
I'm speaking with Jay Watchtell. He served with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms for 23 years. He's now a lecturer at Cal State Fullerton, and he's joining us from NPR West in Culver City, California. And we're talking about the history of what the NRA calls America's rifle, the AR-15 style of rifle, which is a military-style semi-automatic rifle that represents, as we said a little earlier, some 60% of civilian rifle sales in the United States now. And Mr. Watchtell, when you said that that they were available for civilian use almost instantly, I'm looking at a year here from our research, 1963, so almost at exactly the same time that Colt was making them for the military use.
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. So what do you think... They're popular in the civilian market. Wasn't instantaneous in the early 60s, in the 60s and 70s, in comparison to how popular they are now. But what makes them so popular for gun owners and gun enthusiasts in America today?
Well, the capability of the firearm is such that it's like, you know, if you're into cars, I used to like classic cars, so you want the quickest, the best looking. Well, with firearms, the AR-15 and the AR-15 type is the slickest. So people who like firearms are going to like the AR-15 because of its appearance, because of its performance particularly, and because it represents a very important part of our military history. So it has a lot of heritage.
Mm. I read an article from Connecticut that quoted a retired detective there who was talking about how the customizability of the weapon is like, he said the AR-15 is like Legos for grown-ups because you can adapt them for different calibers, different barrel stocks with just a few simple tools. Now, from the point of view of law enforcement, I mean, you served with ATF for more than two decades. What are your concerns about the popularity of AR-15 style rifles in the United States?
Well, one hears a lot about the militarization of the police, you know, police running around in armored cars. Well, that's why. It's the AR-15 and firearms like it that fire these extremely high-velocity projectiles inaccurately. They can pierce any commonly worn body armor, so body armor isn't going to do you any good. So that's why we've got police officers running around in armored vehicles. It has, over the last several decades, drastically changed the nature of policing in the U.S.
That's interesting because I'm also seeing, though, that on the other hand, the industry, the gun industry, is selling AR-15 style rifles to law enforcement and to security. There was a 2015 Smith & Wesson annual report that said that in their language, modern sporting rifles are specifically designed to satisfy the functionality and reliability needs of global military law enforcement and security personnel. So, I mean, is the gun industry being able to sell to both sides here?
Well, they're able to. They've been enabled, and these devastating firearms are now in, you know, the hands of, you know, numerous civilians, and it was done obviously for the sake of a buck.
Now, this isn't the first style of weapon to be available for civilian use and legal sales that's come from a military background. I mean, a lot of firearms historians would say that's sort of the story of weaponry in the United States, but. Do you think, given what you said about the militarization of the police and the concerns that law enforcement have about these kinds of weapons being on the streets, that an assault weapons ban should once again be enacted? I mean, did it make a difference between 94 and 2004 when such a ban was in place?
Well, the original assault weapons ban, I was with ATF, you know, when it was enacted. The original assault weapons ban had absolutely no teeth. It did not prohibit such guns. It prohibited the Colt AR-15 and other weapons by name, and it also prohibited any semi-auto weapons that could accept a detachable magazine and had two or more of certain, you know, external features such as a folding stock or pistol grip or a flash suppressor. What happened was that Colt and the other manufacturers, they just simply renamed their firearms and put out equivalent guns, guns that are just as lethal, but didn't have, you know, a folding stock or pistol grip or whatnot. And they just kept on trucking. So the effect of the assault weapons ban in the real world was nil.
Well, so then what would you recommend? I mean, I hear your concern about these weapons in the United States today. I mean, what would you recommend be done?
Well, I mean, there's talks about bans. I mean, one option that one could take would be to, say, establish a point system where you take ballistics, rapid fire capability, ammunition capacity, accuracy at range, and other things into account, and some weapons, you know, will make it and some won't. But the consequences of making these highly lethal weapons widely available, they can't be addressed by simply tinkering with laws, okay? I mean, we've lost our moral compass, you know. The original assault weapons ban was, when the law was written, those who wrote the law wrote it specifically so that it could be easily circumvented. So, you know, the law reflects really our worst tendencies, you know, to egoism, to self-indulgence. We simply need to get rid of firearms that are these unreasonably lethal. And that would probably extend, you know, further than just simply the AR-15 or AR-15 variants.
Mr. Watchtell, forgive me for saying this, because I know a lot of our listeners right now are shaking their head in vigorous agreement with what you just said. But on the other hand, it also sounds impossible. I mean, it is impossible. There are 8 million of these weapons already in the United States. I mean, that just getting rid of them is never going to happen. So I'm struggling here trying to find if it's not an assault weapons ban, and you know, maybe there's some other other potential laws that we could use. What is there between that and getting rid of the weapons, which just can't happen?
Well, this dilemma was brought on by us ourselves. We brought on this dilemma because of our greed, manufacturers' greed. We also brought it on because of our concern with, you know, individual and corporate rights that overrides any kind of sense, you know, of any kind of a moral compass, or forget the social contract. So what do we do now? Well, we can actually pass an assault weapons ban that has teeth, that doesn't have all the provisions that, you know, would allow manufacturers to simply rename, you know, rebrand their guns and keep on trucking. But beyond that, I think we need a national dialogue. And perhaps the, you know, the poor folks in Orlando, maybe they can help us begin a national dialogue about what do we do now? What is the next step? They're the ones that would know better than anyone else.
Hmm. Well, can I get your view on one last question here? Because the fact that you spent 23 years at ATF, you know, day in and day out working on this issue and thinking about this, and we're, you know, we're talking about a very specific class of firearms, AR-15 style semi-automatic rifles in the United States. But we were looking at FBI statistics, and the FBI says that in 2014, only 248 rifles of any kind were used in gun murders in the United States, compared with more than 5,500 handguns. So I just wonder what your reaction is to that when thinking overall about gun violence.
The problem of gun violence in the U.S., as you indicate, goes way beyond, you know, mass murders. The essential problem here is really not about the law. You know, we keep trying to come up with new laws and new ways of regulating and whatnot. It's not about the law. It's about morality. We really need. I'm not trying to, you know, deflect your question. You mm-hmm. know, but we could be talking about the law, you know, until doomsday. But it's really a problem about morals, about what kind of a country do we want to be. Other countries have dealt with this. For example, Great Britain. And they had, you know, massacres over, you know, in Great Britain. They had a horrible school massacre in the late 90s. And they decided as a country, they came together and they decided to essentially outlaw semi-automatic weapons that fire beyond a .22 caliber rimfire. Yeah. Do we need to go to that extreme? I don't know, but we need a national discussion about it.
Yeah. Mr. Washtell, my last question. I'm going way over time here, but I can't help it. What did you see in your two decades at ATF that led you to this conclusion that essentially you're calling for a moral reckoning in America about our relationship with guns? What did you see on the job?
You know, I had been on the job for 2 years, and I hate to give up my age, but it was in 1975 when I had only been with ATF for a couple of years. I worked my first big gun trafficking case in Phoenix, where somebody was selling guns at a gun show, handguns, large quantities to all buyers. And we did a case on that person for unlicensed dealing, but that person was obtaining their firearms from a local gun dealer over the counter. That local gun dealer was selling this individual dozens of cheap handguns. And I went and I talked to that gun dealer and I said, "What were you thinking? What did you think this man was going to do with them?" Well, the answer was, "Well, I don't know. You know, it was legal to sell. So end of story." That's what we have to deal with.
Well, Jay Watchtell is a retired Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms agent. He served at ATF for 23 years. He's currently a Cal State Fullerton lecturer, and he joins us from Culver City, California. Mr. Watchtell, thank you so very much for your perspective and your time today.
Well, you're welcome.
Listeners, let us know what you think about what you heard about semi-automatic rifles in America and about what Jay Wachtel said about calling for a moral reckoning about our relationship with guns. Send us your comments at radioboston.org. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and yes, it's Wednesday, so that means it's time to talk sports with Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only Game. Hello, Bill.
Hello, Meghna.
Okay, so we get to talk about bait. Just kidding.
Oh, you got me. I usually get you at the beginning of the
conversation. I was like waiting all day for this. We're finally going to talk about soccer. We're going to talk about hooligans in Europe in just a second. Can't wait for that. But first, the Copa America.
And against a little slip, and all of a sudden it's Messi who pounces again, teases onto the left foot for a hat-trick. He made them wait and finally made his appearance in the second half and has produced a magical hat-trick.
Well, that magical hat-trick, of course, coming from Argentina's Leo Messi, scoring his third goal in a game. Last Friday in Chicago, Argentina beat Panama 5-0. That means good news for us here in Massachusetts because Messi is coming here. This Saturday, Argentina will play Venezuela at Gillette in Foxborough. So what's exciting to you other than that news about the Copa America, Bill?
Well, that's where it has to start. Everything that Leo Messi does is exciting to me.
Do you have a Messi jersey?
I have two.
One? You have two of them. Okay.
And I have a Barcelona jersey with UNICEF on the front, the old Barcelona jersey, which I really liked. It's an opportunity to see one of the greatest players in the world at the top of his career here in the U.S. and, of course, frequently in the U.S. when we have seen the players who are the best in the world, they have been somewhat over the crest before we've seen them. And, of course, David Beckham is the prime example of that.
One game I went to see him when he came with L.A. to Foxborough, he sat on the sidelines the whole time.
Yes, but the press conference was magnificent.
Oh, of course. So. And so was his hair.
Anyway, Argentina currently ranked number one in the world, and it'll be great to be able to see Messi playing here and of course, a rare opportunity.
So how's the U.S. doing?
Well, they're doing very well. They're doing as well as they possibly could. There was some dismay when they lost to Colombia in their first game, and it looked as if they might not get out of the group stage, but then they played very well, or certainly well enough in any case, to win their group. And so they will move forward and play Ecuador.
Okay. So let's talk about another exciting moment that happened in Foxborough on Sunday in the Copa America. Peru beat Brazil.
I knew this was going
to
come up.
We have to. Preventing Brazil from making it to the knockout round for the tournament for the first time since 1987. I mean, not having Brazilians in the knockout is amazing. But
absolutely.
It's not a good year for Brazil in any way, shape, or form. But the goal that decided the match was very unusual. It was 0-0, a 0-0 game until a Peruvian player hit the ball. I say hit very specifically because he hit the ball into the goal with his hand. Here's some tape from Fox Sports.
Makes me think that is a handball.
Wow.
I believe Diego Maradona. And they're right. The Brazilian players have an absolute right to be furious there.
So the mention of Maradona and, of course, the hand of God, right?
The malice of Dios. And of course, the story with Diego Maradona's goal was that everybody on the field and in the stadium saw it except the referee. And that's why it was the hand of God. God must have been distracting the referee in some way. And this was very similar. I've watched the replay numbers of times, and it's very hard for me to understand how that goal wasn't called off, because it does seem to be a very obvious handball.
Well, it makes me wonder if I've been hearing things about maybe international soccer maybe using replays one of these days, right?
Yeah, well, they don't now. Yeah. And, there has been some inclusion of technology in international soccer. They have the goal line, little whatever they call it. I'm not very good technically myself, but a little laser thing that could, indicates that the ball has
crossed the line.
But no instant replay, no referee review on something like a handball, and this was certainly one case where Brazilians wish that technology had been in play.
Yeah. Well, let's jump across the Atlantic here for just a second, because we should touch down on the fact that the Euro Cup is underway. And yesterday, UEFA, the group that oversees European soccer, they sanctioned the Russian Soccer Federation for violence. 150 Russian fans charged British fans in the stadium. 35 people were injured. Now, I mean, you know, violence has never fully left the world of international soccer, but this degree, I'm not sure I've seen it in a while.
Well, yeah, I don't think you have seen it in a while, yeah. Because, of course, the heyday of hooliganism, it was in England, certainly, to some extent in some of the other European countries, but it was over. And there were many things that they did in order to... England was penalized. The English fans were banned from crossing into Europe to watch games. They had watch lists for these guys and everything else. So this is something of an anomaly now. I mean, yes, there are raucous crowds and there have been riots, but not nearly as much as, say, 20 years ago. And so this was serious. And the Russians were told, if it happens again, you're out of the tournament.
Yeah.
So it'll be – and some of the Russians were sent home. I mean, some of the worst offenders were sent home from France.
Right. So let's hope that there's an end to that. Ha-ha. Knock on wood. This desk is indeed wood. Well, okay. So in the last couple of seconds that we have, Bill, we have to touch it down on the NBA because we have the sixth game of the NBA Finals tomorrow night in Cleveland. The Cavs are trailing Golden State 2-3. What do you think's going to happen?
Well, I think probably what happens when Draymond Green comes back, having served his one game and thoroughly deserved suspension because you can't go whacking guys within the context of a basketball game or anywhere else, they'll probably Golden State will win. They are an extraordinary team in terms of being able to play basketball as a team. They spread the ball around. They spread the scoring around. They play well even with Stephen Curry on the bench. And I think probably the reason Cleveland did as well as they did in Game 5 was that Draymond Green was missing, and so the team was not a complete team.
Well, Bill Littlefield is host of NPR's Only a Game, which airs on WBUR every Saturday at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. Like Diego Maradona, he is the voice of God. I'll just put it that way.
No, thank you. You're too kind. As long as that's not cheating.
Somewhere Anthony Brooks is shaking his angry fist saying, "You did not talk about the Red Sox." Sorry, Anthony.
It's a long season, Anthony.
Bill, it's always a pleasure to have you.
Me too. Thank you, Megan.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We've had numerous conversations on this show about opioids and the opioid addiction crisis in this country. But today, we want to talk about a specific situation. What happens when someone in addiction recovery from heroin is prescribed opioid painkillers? Well, that's what happened to Seth Mnookin. He's the co-director of the MIT graduate program in science writing, and he's a former heroin addict. Now, he'd been sober since 1997, but a recent surgery for kidney stones, left him dreading what he knew would come next, a prescription of opioid painkillers. Seth wrote about his experience in a piece for Stat News, and he joins us now in the studio to talk about what happened. Seth Mnookin, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's great to have you. Also with us is Dr. Sarah Wakeman. She's the medical director for substance abuse disorders at Massachusetts General Hospital. Dr. Wakeman, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
So, Seth, tell us what happened. You were at MGH, right, for this surgery?
Yes. Yeah, I was actually on a plane and all of a sudden felt like I was dying, was struck with kidney stones and was taken to the emergency room to MGH. And it was clear right away that I was going to need fairly powerful painkillers. I had not gone through a surgery since I had gotten sober. And so that was something that I knew would someday arise for me.
So, I mean, but you were in the emergency room, you said?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. So obviously it's a very tense situation.
Yes.
Lots of activity, lots of people trying to help. At what point, and you're obviously in a great deal of pain. So
right.
At what point in time were you able to communicate to your caregivers
sure, yeah.
that you had a concern?
So as soon as I stopped screaming, essentially, so after the initial pain was treated and we started to talk about the options, so probably about I got to the ER around 11:30, so probably 2 or 3 in the morning, when we started to talk about what the options were moving forward. When we were going over my past medical history, I just said I have a substance use disorder and am in remission for that.
Okay. So how clear were you about what your concern was? Because I'm trying to figure out what is it that a patient can or should say in a situation like that?
So that was essentially all I said, that I have a substance use disorder. I said that to multiple people. I did not say, and therefore my concerns are X, Y, and Z. And that is possibly something that I should have been more explicit about. I assumed that having said that, it would be clear why I was saying that and what my concerns were.
You assumed that?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Now, so what happened then? I mean, you were given eventually a prescription.
Yes. And again, I mean, one thing I want to stress is that I don't think anyone would argue that I should not have been given the prescription. This was by far and away the most excruciating thing I'd ever been through. So I was given a prescription after I had surgery on Monday, and was given a prescription then. What my doctor did was only gave me prescriptions for several days at a time. Mm-hmm. So protocol oftentimes is give a patient a week's worth to start with. And in fact, that's now what's I think mandated in most circumstances by the new Massachusetts law. And I was only given several days at a time. And then over the next week or 10 days, I got several more prescriptions, each for a couple of days at a time. And so in total, I was on opioids for about 2 weeks.
Okay. Dr. Wakeman, I'm going to get to you in just a second.
Yeah, no problem.
But there's a couple of key questions I have for Seth. So you took the prescription.
Yes.
And had you taken an opioid-based painkiller beforehand?
No. The last time I had any opioids in my system was in 1997.
Okay. And so what was your body's reaction?
So I actually was surprised. I mean, it helped with the pain, but I was not getting high at all. I didn't feel impaired. Neither my wife nor my colleagues thought that I was impaired. I took some steps, like I gave them to my wife to give to me. So she would only give me 2 every 4 to 6 hours. And ideally, I wouldn't be taking that much. But I didn't – there wasn't anything that I noticed. My body wasn't like, oh, this is what – I remember this. The things that I noticed were that I was itchy, which is something mm-hmm. that happened a lot. But I didn't notice the sort of high-like effect.
Were you concerned nevertheless?
I wasn't really concerned during that time because I felt like I was taking all the steps. You know, I was giving them to my wife. I wasn't taking more than were prescribed, and I was trying to take less. And so I was not really concerned about that. What caught me unaware was then when I stopped after 2 weeks, when I could stop them, I then had a couple of days, a day and a half of withdrawal symptoms. And that was something I was completely unprepared for just because I had no sense that that could occur that quickly. I assumed that it would take longer for that type of – any type of physical dependence to kick in.
Yeah. So one more thing, because help me understand you did write in your article for Stat that there was a point in which you were frustrated and you felt that you were trying to communicate things to hospital staff that you didn't feel were heard appropriately. Is that right? Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah. Well, there was – so my wife also asked the surgeon after my surgery if she knew that I had a substance use disorder. And the surgeon at that moment said no. I think that the surgeon misspoke, and she had been aware, but as she explained it to me later, she's focused on that point at my aftercare and my well-being. She had discussed this with her surgical team before surgery. But yeah, that was something that concerned us a little bit. And the other thing, I guess, that concerned me was and this is something that I thought about more after the fact, but I was surprised that there was not some discussion about the proper way to use opioids. Uh-huh. And I think I took all the right steps, but I was thinking of it more from the perspective of someone who comes in and is not married or does not give them to their wife or spouse. What are they going to do? And then when I realized after 2 weeks that I felt signs of physical dependence, that was when I really started to think of, you know, we need some more steps here.
So Dr. Wakeman, thank you so much for being so patient and for being here with us, because this is exactly the reason why we're delighted to have you as part of this conversation. Because as more and more, as we talk more and more openly about substance abuse disorders and people's challenges with them, there are more and more places in life where there are potential, you know, points of weakness, and weakness not for the person, but systematically. And so I'm wondering, ideally, you know, in for someone who's in a situation like Seth's and they're in the hospital for an issue that's totally unrelated to this other thing, like, what should they be doing? How should they be advocating? And what should a hospital's protocol be?
Yeah, so first, thanks for having me. And I think, you know, Seth was very brave and courageous, actually, in being so forthcoming about his history of a substance use disorder. Unfortunately, there still is a lot of stigma. And so I have a lot of patients who don't always feel comfortable volunteering that information. And so, as he points out, he was a person in long-term recovery and a person who felt sort of comfortable sharing that information. And so so I think he should be congratulated for that, and also sort of addresses the broader issues of stigma in our system.
Well, let me just jump in here, because, I have some very practical questions. Like, say I were to, any person were going to the ER at MGH. I mean, in the some point in time, someone takes your history, right? Mm-hmm. Do you specifically ask patients now about substance abuse?
So, you know, it's a funny time right now. So the hospital has taken on addiction really as its key clinical priority since 2014, and has committed a huge amount of support and resource to developing really a system-wide level of care for patients with active substance use disorder. And more recently, since last fall, we've convened an opioid task force, which is really focused around this issue. So how do we both compassionately manage care for all patients, including patients in remission from a substance use disorder, and how do we safely prescribe opioids in a way that minimizes unnecessary exposure both to the patient and the community while addressing someone's pain. And so those guidelines are actually being rolled out later this month. Right. A part of that guideline is to screen every patient before you prescribe an opioid. So going forward, there are validated screening tools that include asking about a personal history of substance use disorder and a number of other questions that can help you decide sort of what is the risk to that individual patient and how can you tailor the treatment plan to them.
Well, so Seth, tell us a little more specifically about, you know, one or two of the additional measures that you thought or you think should be in place that, you know,
Based
on your experience.
Even, I mean, I think one of the challenges here is that when you're seeing a surgeon or when you're seeing your doctor, though they are not trained in addiction medicine, and that is a whole other specialty for a reason. And so I think we need to look at ways that this can be addressed without placing a huge burden on caregivers and care providers. But I think something as simple as an information sheet about what you can expect, about these are things that you should look out for, one of the things that surprised me is when I started feeling withdrawal symptoms, I didn't recognize them as that. Uh-huh. I was actually concerned that I developed a secondary infection. So even something saying, after stopping use, you may experience agitation, sleeplessness, aches, some slight aches and pains. But more information, I think it would accomplish a couple of things. One, putting that on the table, but also, as Sarah talked about, removing some of the stigma and acknowledging that this is something that happens all the time. Opioids are powerful drugs, and it's easy to misuse them. And it's something that everyone in the system needs to be aware of.
Dr. Wakeman, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think, you know, that is part of the approach that we're taking. I think that notion of kind of shared decision making with a patient, that you tailor your plan to that individual patient, and someone in recovery from a substance use disorder has a different level of risk than someone who's never had it. Unfortunately, when you're first starting an opioid in someone, you have no idea what their individual risk is. We know that addiction is about 50% genetic, and we don't yet have the tools to sort of identify who's going to be at risk of developing an opioid use disorder after exposure. And so that's where that idea of carefully screening patients and then really sort of monitoring them with short prescriptions and close follow-up is so important.
I take Seth's point that there can be additional places in the process of a treatment process or a treatment plan to put some safeguards in place. But you know, after your article came out, Seth, I mean, there's some people did feel they needed to push back a little because, you know, there are some physicians out there who feel like these additional, I don't want to call them that they object to the safeguards, but there's a concern that physicians are having their hands further tied, or that for people who genuinely need the prescriptions, that it's getting ever harder and the additional bureaucracy around it continues to make it harder. And I was just wondering what your reactions are to that.
I mean, I think it is crucial to acknowledge that the reason opioids are used in hospital and care settings is because they're oftentimes needed. And I certainly was not saying in the least that we should not use them or even that I should not have been given them. So I think that is a misinterpretation of the point that I was trying to make. And I also don't think that doctors should have additional burdens placed on them. What I'm talking about more is things that can be built into the system.
Yeah.
And I think this is an instance in which information goes a long way.
We just have a couple seconds, but
yeah,
Dr.
Sure.
Wakeman.
I would just say we're in this transition point of really recognizing and treating addiction as a chronic disease. And so in the same way that we address hypertension and diabetes and all of these other past medical histories as a part of the overall care plan, I think people like Seth speaking out are helping us in that process of moving towards addressing addiction the same way.
Well, Dr. Sarah Wakeman is Medical Director for Substance Use Disorders at Massachusetts General Hospital. Dr. Wakeman, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And Seth Manoukian, co-director of MIT's graduate program in science writing and author of many books, including The Panic Virus. His article on his experience in the emergency room and with opioid painkillers, we've got it linked at radioboston.org. Seth, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.